need to be able to be out at 1:30 because of a teaching commitment at Ur-Chaim. So what that means is that I want to try to start as close to 12:30 as possible so I don't cheat you of the time that we do have. Does everyone have sheets? There are a couple of spares that are on in the shtender over there. That shtender is good for something. I do see that there are some people here who weren't here last week. I want to make sure that you're on the email list so that I can send you the sheets in advance in general, as well as follow up on the classes. So if I don't have you on the email list, since I'm going to be running out at the end, that'll be a little bit of a trick in terms of getting the emails.
I'll get you.
Okay. Perfect timing. That's Rebecca Nadler, for those who don't know her. And Rebecca is the one who made all of this possible and is the coordinator of the series and of Mikarot in general. She runs Mikarot. And please, if you have not yet registered, please see Rebecca. Okay. Last week, we began with an introduction to Medrash. We ran through, frankly, a little quicker than I probably should have. Just some basic ideas regarding Medrash. Afterwards, I received a few emails that suggested I do need to clarify one thing, at least one thing, but one thing that I know of. And that is that at the end, I brought a source from Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch in which he talks about the openness of Medrash and distinguishes between Halacha and, or Shmaitza, as he calls it, and Agadita. There is received tradition which speaks to law, and then there is agarata lehagid, that which we can speak and suggest, that is essentially our opportunity to find insight in the Torah's verses, in the Torah's psukim, in the stories, in the laws, and to try to explain them ourselves. And what Rav Hirsch said, there are sheets still here. What Rav Hirsch had said was that when it comes to Shmaitza, when it comes to revelation, to revealed tradition, you can't innovate and invent. However, when it comes to Agadata, Lahagid, that which one speaks, that commentary, he says, anybody can find lessons, and in any generation, so long as it is consistent with Shmaitza, as long as it's consistent with that which has been revealed to us, the halacha that we have. That was Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch's statement. So a few people emailed me afterwards wanting clarification then. Does that mean that I could comment on a verse in Parshat Noach, like we're going to be seeing today, and come up with my own idea and consider it the equivalent of that which we're going to be studying in Medrash Rabbah? And my answer, unfortunately, is I wouldn't consider it the equivalent. Because keep in mind, number one, that there is a classic debate regarding the degree of what's called Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration of those who are actually putting together the canonized Medrash. So even if I am free to come up with a comment, that doesn't mean it's the same as what they did. That's number one. And then number two, what they write is informed by the way they look at the psukim, the way they look at the text, and the fine eye that they apply to it, and the ideas from elsewhere in Torah, in Tanakh, that they link to it, which they're able to do because they have a larger database in their heads on which to draw. And that's going to become, I think, very clear today. We'll see an example of this today. The way that they can connect a verse in Proverbs with a verse in Noach, with a verse in Eov, and use it to explain ideas and to explain textual anomalies, that's something that, when you can do something like that, you're on a different level, and you're operating on a different plane, and I don't think it should be equated with a comment that I'm going to make where I see a verse and think to myself, well, gee, maybe this is teaching me such and such. The level of expertise that you bring to any field dictates the seriousness with which your words will be taken. Is that clear? I feel like I talked around it without giving an example, but the example today, I think, will do. So
what would be the point, then, if we can,
yes,
be arbitrary? What would be the point of our commenting, then, if we bring something that's not particularly valid, comparable to Chazal?
Good. So Dorothy Deborah asks, then what is the point of authoring our own comments? Maybe I should just study what they had, and why am I putting in the effort to create my own thoughts? I would suggest a couple of things. Number one, because I think we often learn best from that which we produce, as opposed to that which other people tell us. right? In teaching, they say that it's always best for the students to come up with the idea themselves as opposed to for someone to tell it to them, the whole Socratic method. I think that a lesson that I can learn by my own deduction, by seeing this, may be something that I will actually get more out of, and as long as it's consistent with other ideas, it's valuable. That's number one. Number two, I think the exercise is very important. In other words, Talmud Torah, the act of studying Torah, is immensely valuable, even if I never produce anything new. Just the fact that I take it seriously and in depth. That's a second point. And then a third point that's worth considering is the idea that the sages have of Makom Hinichu Lano Avosenu Lehisgader Bo, which means our ancestors left us a place that we can, in which we can innovate, in which we can add. And the idea that not everything in Torah has actually been published, so to speak. There are ideas that are left for us to come up with, and each of us, bringing our own personality, our own experiences, do have the possibility of coming up with a new thought. That's an idea that really deserves its own exploration. But I do think that there is still value in doing it. Okay. So we're going to be looking at Medrash Rabbah on Parshat Noach. And again, if you didn't catch the audio from last week and you weren't here last week, I do recommend trying to catch the recording. I hope later today to send out the link to it again. I sent it out last week also after the first class, because there we talked more about what Medrash is and what Bereishit Rabbah, this body of Medrash, is. The text I have here is an all Hebrew one. As I've already noted, there aren't translations out there of Bereishit Rabbah, with the exception of the Sansino one, and I'm told that it's something like a 9-volume set, so if you want to buy a 9-volume set for the sake of the course, that's wonderful. But what I'm planning on doing, and not just for the sake of the course, you'll have it to learn from, but what I am planning on doing, as I did today, is to include on your source sheets the text of the Medrash we're going to study in Hebrew, and then with my own translation, and to work from there. So the Midrashim in general at the start of the Parsha of Noach are what I have come to think of as Midrashim of the Tzaddik. Okay, Tzaddik, a righteous person. Tzaddik is a term used to describe Noach. The reason I call them Midrashim of the Tzaddik is because they're about that first sentence in the Parsha of Noach, which begins, Ela Toldot Noach, these are the generations of Noach, that which Noach produced. A Tolada is that which one produces. So, how do we say birthday in Hebrew? Huladet. Right, birth. Leida is the act of birth. Toladot, that which is birthed by. So, it doesn't have to mean generations literally, as we're going to see. It means that which Noach produced. These are the products of Noach, if you will. So these are, but I'm going to call them generations because that's the standard translation that's used. The parasha of Noach begins, Ela toldot Noach, these are the generations of Noach. Noach ish tzaddik, Noach was a righteous man. Tamim haya bedorotav, he was complete, perfect, unblemished in his generation. Et ha'lokim hitalech Noach, Noach walked with God. That's the sentence in its complete form. And what I'm hoping to do as we go through the Midrashim on that sentence are to ask each time, as we go through each Midrash, to ask three questions. Number one, what does the Midrash seem to be saying? Number two, where does the Midrash find this? What are the keys in the sentences that the Midrash will quote? Remember I said last week that where Pshat is the study of story, Midrash is the study of language. We need to find out where does the Midrash see the cues in the language of the Torah to get its lessons. And then third, so what are the takeaway messages of this Midrash? That's the basic approach I want to use. Yeah.
Could you ask the question, and it might be encompassing more to maybe one, but also two, like what was the problem that the Midrash is addressing?
Yeah, no, when I ask what are the textual cues, that's what I mean. What problem? Sometimes the problem isn't textual. Sometimes the problem is storyline.
Right.
What we'll be seeing is largely textual in the first sentence in Noach, but yeah, sometimes it will be beyond the text, and just generally, what problem are we trying to solve within the story as well? Okay. So we take a look first at the Midrash itself. One of the things that really bother me about Jewish publishing in general is the way that publishers have made learning Torah very difficult. And it's not entirely their fault. They were dealing over the centuries with the problem of, number one, the difficulty of using mechanical type when they first started using a printing press, and number two, the expense involved. But the result is that everything that appears in Torah, whether you're talking about in Medrash like we have here, whether you're talking about in a Gemara, whether you're talking about in a Chumash, everything is in block paragraphs. And it makes things very hard to read because often there's a dialogue going on, like in this Medrash that we're going to see here. There's a dialogue going on. And you can't read dialogue in a paragraph. Imagine if you picked up a novel and the characters are talking to each other and it's all just in a paragraph. It becomes very hard to read and figure out what's going on. My biggest complaint isn't about Torah study. My biggest complaint is the Siddur, where they take Tehillim, Psalms, which are meant to be poetry, and they put them in block paragraphs. Like, how can you appreciate a psalm written in a block paragraph? It doesn't make any sense. So Koren tries in some of them to try to make it clearer. There was a reform prayer book that actually came out a few years ago that tried to also do it in poem form. We need it desperately. I mean, it's just, but that's a separate rant. The point here is that I took what appears in your normal work of Medrash in a block paragraph and tried to break it up into outline form, and I hope that it will make this Medrash easier. Okay, so it begins with the sentence itself. You'll see the superscript letter Aleph in the Hebrew, or the number one if you use the English. That's because this Medrash technically is broken up into two different Midrashim. It's two separate paragraphs in the body of Medrash, so there's an Aleph and a Bet, a one and a two. Ela toldot Noach, Noach ish tzadik tamim. The first thing you notice is that this Medrash stops after the word tamim, even though tamim is mid-clause in the sentence. That's okay. Medrash is able to do that. As it happens, it doesn't affect this Medrash anyway. In other words, they expect you to know the rest of the sentence. Sometimes you will find in the Midrashic method they will stop mid-clause and actually analyze something and give it an entirely different perspective by stopping in what seems to be linguistically mid-clause. Here, it's not like there's no special message in that. They're not even going to use the word tamim in this medrash. So Ela told Noach, these are the generations of Noach. Noach was a righteous man, complete, etc. And the medrash begins the first of three different takes on this sentence. First take: Hahu dichsiv. They refer you to a sentence in Mishlei. Mishlei 10:25. I gave you in the translation. Ka'avor sufa ve'ein rasha v'tzadik yesod olam. I tried to underline the sentences that they draw from elsewhere in Tanakh so that it'll be easier to reference. When the storm passes and there is no wicked person and the righteous person is an eternal foundation. So Kavor sufa vein rasha. When the storm passes, there's no wicked person, right? That's obviously Zedo Amabul. That's the flood. There was a storm. It lasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and then no wicked people anymore. Vitzadik yisod olam, and the righteous person is an eternal foundation. Now that's one way to take that sentence. How else could you translate tzadik yisod olam?
Foundation of the world.
The word olam may mean the universe, the world, a physical universe, or olam may mean eternity. If you think of the line in Kaddish, right? Yehesh me rabam v'arach, may Gazim be blessed le'olam forever, ula'ol may ol maya, and for all eternity. Olam can also mean across time, not just space. So right now I'm doing it across time because that's the way the translators tend to take this sentence, but we're going to come back to that. The tzaddik is an eternal foundation, that is Noach. And then they quote a second sentence, also from Mishlei, from Proverbs. Hafoch reshaim ve'einam, overturn the wicked, they will not exist. Ubeit tzaddikim ya'amod, and the house of the righteous will stand. And again, they break it down and say the first half of the sentence about overturning the wicked and they don't exist, that's the generation of the flood. And the house of the righteous will stand, that is Noach. And they say, Hahu dichsiv Ela told us Noach. That's what it means when it says, these are the generations of Noach. That's the first part of it. What are they trying to say in that first part? What is the Medrash trying to teach me? Not so easy, huh?
I'll take a stab and somebody else can follow after me. Okay.
Go ahead.
So we're trying to understand, trying to grapple with this question of that Noah is a righteous person, and in this time which we, and in a strange time. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean he's the righteous person, and what else is going on there, and how does he become the singular? And so they're trying to create a situation where he's the singular individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but how does that tie into Eila Toldo Noach? Just because now we're learning about Noach and therefore, but keep in mind this isn't the first time Noach appears, right? Noach is praised already at the end of Parashat Bereishit, the couple of sentences earlier. So I think there has to be something tied to the language in this sentence. That's number one. But number two, Medrash has a way of tricking you based on the way it was canonized. We approach this sentence, and I say we, I mean me anyway, royal we, by assuming that the goal of this medrash is to explain the first sentence in Parashat Noach, because that's what we started with, right? But in fact, you could flip this on its head and say that's not what it's for. It's actually there to explain the sentences they brought you from Mishlei, from Proverbs. In other words, here you have a sentence in Proverbs which says, the storm passes and there are no more wicked people. The righteous person is an eternal foundation. And the sages look at that sentence and say, is that just a statement in a vacuum? No, it's a statement about Noah. It's a reference to a particular historical event. So in other words, this medrash is in some sense not a commentary on Noah, but a commentary on Mishlei, on Proverbs. Anytime you see a medrash quote you psukim, quote you verses, you have to ask yourself which verse is this really here to explain. And in some sense, it's actually here to explain the Mishlei, which is why you will find midrashim that appear in multiple volumes. You will find a medrash that will appear in Bereishit Rabbah on Noah, and it will also appear in medrash on the book of Mishlei, because it's actually rooted in Mishlei, it just happens to relate to here.
So is it a more general statement in Mishlei?
Yes,
not,
so it appears.
It's not specific, it's about the state of the world.
But we're citing the particular example of Noah.
It's because we're connected.
Yeah.
Is it just an example, or can it mean also in the Mishlei some unknown time in the future?
I suppose, hypothetically, it could be a reference to some future event. This medrash is tying it to Noah. Mishlei we generally understand not to be a prophecy about the future. As a general rule, when we approach Mishlei, it's understood to be Shlomo's wisdom that he's offering, which may have insights regarding the past. It's not generally looked at as it's Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, but it's not necessarily viewed as prophecy for the future. But it's always possible. But in terms of the lesson it wants us to learn, I would take it on a very simple and straightforward level, that it's telling us that Noah's righteousness led to the survival of the world, and therefore, what it's really doing is going back to the opening sentence of Parshat Noah and asking a question. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, complete in his time, dot, dot, dot. Is that what you would have expected for a verse that's going to tell us about the generations of Noah? Shana?
No, you'd expect a bunch of begats.
Yeah. That's what I would have expected, right? I would have expected, and Noah begat, like Noah and, by the way, his wife Naama, begat Shem, Ham, and Yefet. Right? And then Shem begat Arpachshad, and Arpachshad begat Eber. And I would have expected you to go down the generations. What should have happened here is what happens elsewhere in the Torah when it says, Eileh Toldot, these are the generations of. It then gives us the biological generations. And even though Torchiner sort of clued you in a few minutes ago by saying Toldot doesn't have to mean generations, it can mean products, the default assumption is it means generations. So the Medrash is bothered by the fact that it said these are the generations. And then it went off on a tangent about how nice a person Noah is. A few sentences later, it's going to tell us about Shem, Ham, and Yefet, the three sons of Noah. Why didn't it do that right away? So the first part of this medrash is answering us by telling us, because Tzadik Yesod Olam, the righteous person is the eternal foundation, and therefore, Noach being a tzaddik, Noach being righteous, is what created Toldot Noach, the future generations of Noach. It was his righteousness that guaranteed there would be generations. So the first part of the Medrash, let's look at it carefully. The first part of the Medrash is saying, these are the generations of Noach. Noach was righteous. How does part A link to part B? The answer is because the righteous person is an eternal foundation, the house of the righteous will stand. It was his righteousness that created future generations.
But there's no guarantee that everybody in future generations will be as righteous as him.
That's for sure. Nor does there have to be, apparently.
Apparently,
you can have merit which will support future generations even if they are not particularly worthy. We depend on that in Judaism. Yes.
It is a philosophy that the world stands because there are 12 tzaddikim.
Right, so the Talmud actually has different numbers. It brings a whole host of numbers. Absolutely true. Here it's dealing with earlier generations supporting later ones. But
so
yes.
Even if the future generations aren't so righteous, those 12
tzaddikim,
mm-hmm.
They hold up the world. Right. Good. So yes, it's true. It doesn't have to be over time. It can also be simultaneous. Mm-hmm. So the first part of this Medrash, which we're going to come back to, right now we're just doing a simple read, and it may well take us 2 weeks to go through this Medrash. I'm okay with that idea. Hope you are. The opening segment of the three parts is trying to tell me that the Torah is giving me a message. These are the generations of Noach. Noach was righteous. Righteousness is what creates future generations. That's the message that it's telling me. That's number one. But then it goes on. Second part. And we're going to come back to the first part. We're not done with the first part. The Davar Acher. When you see the Dalet Aleph there in the Hebrew, that stands for Davar Acher. It means another thought. Ela Toldot Noach. Once again, we come back to those words. And we quote another sentence from Mishlei, from Proverbs. Mishlei is a great resource in Medrash. They love sentences from Mishlei because no one understands Mishlei. The Ketiv sentence says, Beit Rishaim Yishamed, the Oel Yisharim Yafriach. The house of the wicked will be destroyed. The tent of the righteous will flower. So, Beit Rishaim Yishamed, the house of the wicked will be destroyed. That is, the generation of the flood. The tent of the righteous will flower, will blossom. That refers to Noah. What has the second part added to the first part? The first part already told me about righteousness enabling survival. What is now added?
It gives me a lot of children.
Right, it's the flowering. It's not just survival. But it is to flower. To flower connotes that there will be many, but also a certain beauty, I think, that it bears fruit. Right? I'm jumping from flowers to fruit. There are bees along the way. But the idea is that flowering is a sense of productivity. So there's beauty and there's productivity. It's not only that there's survival. It's adding a layer. Shana.
When you read it, I thought that the contrast was between a house and a tent, that the wicked seem to be more established and have more material stability, but that's not going to last, whereas the temporary tent is the one that persists.
Very good. We're going to come back to the thought.
Can I? But what a question I have is, why would this be a Davar Acher, an alternative thing? Why is this not building one after the other?
Right.
Like, why would...
Good.
This isn't really an alternative read, it's more of a adding an additional thought to previous words.
Right, and I was sloppy in my language. You're right. Davar Acher can absolutely be adding on to and not necessarily contradicting. I don't see this as contradicting what came before, but it's simply adding a layer.
Okay.
And then the third part of the three. In the Hebrew where you have the superscript base, in the English you have the superscript number two. I just like saying superscript. Davar Acher. Ela Toldot Noach. These are, once again, the generations of Noach. And they quote you a pasuk, a sentence now from Eov. Kalhu al pnei hamayim. Tekulal chelkasam ba'aretz lo yifne derech kiramim. He is swift upon the face of the water. We're taking the word kal to mean swift. We're going to have to come back to that word. To kulal chelkasam ba'aretz, their portion is cursed in the land. He will not turn to the path of the vineyards. If you are confused by that sentence, you are so not alone. We have to understand what this sentence means. We're going to look at it in the eyes of the Medrash, but we're going to have to come back to this sentence. Kal hu al pnei hamayim. He is swift upon the face of the water. That is, gezerah shenigzera aleihem sheyovdu b'mayim. The decree issued upon them, upon the generations of that time, that they would be destroyed with water. So this also we take back to the flood. Tikhulal chelkasam ba'aretz. Their portion will be cursed in the land. Klomar, as if to say, mi shepara midor hamabul. May the one who punished the generation of the flood. If that doesn't make any sense, that's just fine. We're going to come back to all of this in a moment. Kol kach lama. And why to such an extent? Because lo yifne derech keramim. Because he did not turn, or he would not turn, to the path of the vineyards. Shalom haisa kavanasan elo mataas keramim. Because they only intended to plant vineyards. Aval. Noach lo haisa kavanaso el lahafros ulaharbos ba'olam. But Noach only intended to bear fruit and to multiply in the world, ulahamid banim, and to produce children, shenamar ela toldos Noach. As the verse says, these are the generations of Noach. What are you talking about? So I am going to do a digest of this, and then we're going to have to come back to it. But I want to do just a quick explanation. The way to read this third part is, a decree was issued that the generation of the flood would in fact be destroyed with water. The phrase Misha Para Midor Mabul we're going to come back to, but it's a phrase referring to divine anger at the generation of the flood. And we say that the sin of the generation of the flood is that they would not do anything other than plant vineyards. What does planting a vineyard connote to you? Leaving Noah out of the picture, because we have to come back to that.
First thing he does.
We're going to get to that, yes.
Their own pleasure.
The idea is plant a vineyard, get grapes, get wine, get drunk. That's the assumption. So that's the statement here, is they only wanted to plant vineyards, whereas Noah was trying to build up the world. Noah wanted to have children. Noah wanted to create toladot, generations. This is a radically different read of the first sentence in Parshat Noah. Because this read says, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was righteous. Meaning, because Noah had generations, he was righteous. Attempting to build up the world was what made him a righteous person, or was characteristic of his righteousness. So whereas the first approach was to read this sentence as Noah was righteous, therefore there were generations. Second way was Noah was righteous, therefore his family flowered. The third take is Noah was righteous as seen in the fact that he produced generations. It's a different read, right? You follow? That's the idea. Now, what we just did to this medrash was really to take out all of the wiring, so to speak, in order to just get a summary. But there's much more to be discussed here. So let's see what we can do with this. But already we've gained something, right? Already now, I should not look at the first sentence in Parshat Noach the same way when Noach comes around next year. Because now I have a whole different understanding of the way this works. And of course, everyone will remember this and say it, you know, when we get to Parshat Noach, and it will be beautiful. Okay. Yes?
What I understood is that you're making a definition of what tzaddik means.
Yeah.
A different definition from what I thought.
Okay. And that's, I think, I know, the last part of it I can't testify to, but the first part, yes. I think this is redefining tzaddik.
Yes.
Yeah. Tzaddik is someone who's interested in building up the world.
Very big statement, though. I mean, it's overturning to some extent, because in my head, it doesn't mean that Dor HaMabul didn't have children. But the fact that they would, you know, nowhere does it say that that's what they did not do.
Correct.
There was Hamas, and Hamas, we know, isn't isn't good at all, but it doesn't. So.
So Hannah points out something very interesting. This, and I think you're 100% right. What this Medrash has done is it's given us an insight into the sin of the generation of the flood, which really doesn't appear at all in the sentences in Bereishit. It's telling me that if you want to understand what happened at the flood, you know what you have to do? You have to learn Eov. You have to learn the book of Job. And there you'll find an explanation for what happened in the time of the flood. That's a remarkable idea. It speaks to the interconnectedness of Torah, certainly within the minds of the author of the Medrash. And to go back to the point that I made in the beginning about, you know, the authority that one brings to creating a Medrash and to saying, okay, here is an explanation of what the biblical sentence says, they're not playing on the same playing field that that most people are. You know, the idea that if I want to understand the sin of the flood, I'm going to have to know a sentence in Eov and be able to make that application is not simple and straightforward. But once they do it, once they call up this sentence in Eov, in Job, which talks about the water and the decree of destruction on the water, oh, well, that's the flood. And then what's wrong? Look in the sentence, and it says they didn't turn to the vineyards and so on. That's a once they've done that for you, you understand what they're doing. But it's not simple and straightforward. I wouldn't have approached Parashat Noach by thinking of Eov at all. Right? Job doesn't lend himself to Noah, although there are connections between the two of them, which is a little bit beyond the scope of where we're going to go. But I want to understand this Medrash better. There's so much more that we can get from this Medrash. So let's look at the sentences that were quoted and see what drives this Medrash. Again, I'm going to keep on repeating it because I like the phrase. Medrash is the study of language. That's what this is fundamentally about. Yes, there'll be questions about storyline also, but it's really looking at language to solve the questions about storyline anyway.
I wasn't necessarily thinking storyline. I was really thinking, like, what's the problem? Like, what are we, when we look at these words, what bothers us? What questions come to mind? Like, why did they phrase it that way?
Right. Okay, well, then that's exactly where we're going. Okay. So, what I want to do here is get a sense of the verses and what we are drawing on in this case. Now, on your sheets, on the flip side, number two, I wrote one question, three answers. The goal of that section was for those who want to be able to write it down to actually, note, okay, this is what we've said in each part of this. If you find it useful, great. If you don't find it useful, then you have more white space on your paper. But right now, the answers are righteousness led to the survival of the world, righteousness led to the family flowering, or his righteousness, which saved his family, was his interest in building up the world. Okay. Now we go to get what I hope will be a deeper understanding of this. Stage one in the Medrash. We quoted a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, which said, when the storm passes, and there is no wicked one, and the righteous person is an eternal foundation. Remember that again, this Medrash is not only commenting on our verse from Noah, it's commenting on these verses from Mishlei, from Proverbs. What would you ask faced with that sentence? What in that sentence from Mishlei, 10:25, what sentence there, what aspect of the sentence is challenging? Okay. Sorry?
I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Why tzaddikim aren't the foundation of the world, even if there are the tzaddikim?
What do you mean?
It says here that when there are no more rishayim, then the tzaddikim are the foundation of the world.
Mm.
So what if there are rishayim? Right. They're still the foundation of the world.
Right. Now, I think that it isn't using the cup and kavur, or the when, as I put it in the translation, quite as a contrast to say, or not a sorry, it's using it as a contrast rather than as a statement of when this happens, then this is true. Rather, it's saying, when the storm passes, there will be no more wicked people. In other words, the storm is going to come along and take them away. Exactly. Whereas the righteous people, they're going to remain around. By the way, we are entirely pretending that there is no question of theodicy in the course of this this discussion. In other words, it's all well and good to say, see that, the wicked get wiped away by the storm and the righteous person survived. But the story of Noah may well be the last time that ever happened. That's exaggeration. But my point is that you could have a whole other layer here, which is to ask, if these observations are true, where is this in our own lives? It's just not, within the scope of understanding this medrash, it's not going to come up. But the question that I see on this verse is the one that Shana noted before, which is that Vitzadik Yesod Olam, the righteous person, I had translated, is an eternal foundation, could also be translated as the righteous person is a foundation of the world. Right? The righteous person is a foundation of the world. And I think that that's actually what our Medrash is doing. Our Medrash is not looking at it as the righteous person is an eternal foundation. It's trying to show Noah was the foundation of the world. Because if not for Noah, humanity comes to an end. He was the foundation of the world. So I think what we're doing in the Medrash is we're specifically playing on this play on words of Yesod Olam, turning it from eternal foundation to foundation of the world. That's number one. Number two is the other sentence that they quote here.
And why would you initially have felt the need to attach Yesod to Olam rather than Yesod to Tzadik? Because that's what you and Shane initiated was what was to, the Tzadik is the foundation rather than the eternal foundation, putting those the last two words together. It's
right.
A question which you've been, why did you initially want to group it with the world?
So I think either read actually groups Yesod with Olam. It's only a question of how I'm going to translate Olam. And the normal approach by the commentators, is to assume Olam is eternal there. I think because they're contrasting the temporary nature of the wicked person. The storm blows and the wicked person is gone and the tzaddik remains forever. I think that's the pshat read. That will be the simple read, is transient versus permanent. And it's only the medrash that is coming along and saying you could read Yesod Olam not as being about permanence, but rather as being about the foundation of the world as Noah was. So I think that's what's going on. Okay. I don't see how you would read the sentence, though.
Yes, you could put a comma there.
Then how? How would you translate the sentence, then?
Both the wicked and... both the wicked and the righteous are not the foundation of the world.
But literally, how will you translate the sentence? You're stuck with the words Yesod Olam at the end of the sentence.
The storm passes. If you're rid of the Zik and the Rasha and then you have the foundation of the world.
In our seventh week, it's a philosophical statement.
Right, but you're lost on the last two words. What do you do with the last two words of the sentence?
Both are not the...
Oh, in other words, if you wanted to read it as Kavor Sufa, Ve'in Rasha V'Tzadik Yesod Olam.
Because there's a Ve'in Rasha V'Tzadik.
All right. I wouldn't read it that way, particularly because of the trap, the way the notes are. The notes have a pause on Rasha, the Anachta there. But, yeah. Okay.
That's a comma.
Yeah.
It's a comma.
Yeah. Okay. The second sentence that they quote here, where they say, and this is still in the first part, overturn the wicked, and they are no longer, and the house of the righteous will stand. So, what I'm not clear on is what is this sentence adding to the previous one? Is the second sentence adding anything? The second sentence from Mishlei, from Proverbs, is it adding anything to the one before it? That's an interesting possibility.
What about even if there is no storm?
Even if there is no storm, because it doesn't say anything about a storm in particular. It just says, it says overturn them. I mean, overturning them is some other cataclysm.
Yeah, it's not necessarily.
Maybe.
Maybe if it says the house, it means the foundation of this world as opposed to internal foundation as we thought previously.
House as a more this world type of a... That could be. That could be. The house as giving this physical aspect to it could be. I would look at it and say it doesn't need to add anything. Because since the Medrash could be a commentary on Mishlei, on Proverbs, and not really on our portion, it doesn't add a thing to our understanding of Noach and his story. However, it's explaining yet another sentence from Proverbs. I think that's another way that it could be taken. I don't have a definitive answer. But I think the answers that were suggested here, the plural, the grounding in this world, I think these are all good answers. But that's, I think, another possibility. So our first stage is to say that the righteous person is going to cause the survival of the world, and we're playing on, perhaps, the Yesod Olam to make it, instead of eternal foundation of the world, as Noah was. That brings us to the second stage of the Medrash, which used the sentence also from Mishlei, Beit Rishaim Yishameh, the house of the wicked will be destroyed, V'ohel Yisharim Yafriach, and the tent of the righteous will flower. So what are the questions here?
Well, first is, what is it adding?
Right, well, we know what we're adding, Yafriach, and the flower.
Apart from parallelism, I'm struck by the fact that the Rishaim have a house, and the poor Yesharim only have an
ohel. Right, and that goes going back to the going back to the point that Shana made before, is that, and the Chana makes now, this bayit and ohel, a house connotes permanence. A tent is something temporary, flimsy. It's also interesting that we've changed our label for the righteous. Right, the righteous before were tzaddikim. Now we're talking about Yesharim. Yashar generally means someone who is righteous. Certainly when we translate them into English, we tend to view them as synonymous. But it isn't necessarily so. Yashar specifically connotes integrity. Someone who is straight. As opposed to tzaddik, which may have a connotation of righteousness that even transcends integrity and becomes more about generosity, becomes more about transcending obligations. So it's there could be a difference there as well. And then the question of what do we mean by flowering here? What exactly is flowering about? So those are some of the questions that we may be dealing with when we bring in this sentence. And then we go to the third part. I'm going to come back to the second part. I want to ask all the questions first, I think, and then put it together.
Can you talk about perhaps permanence being a state of mind and rigid, and flowering, growth, being a state of mind that is creative and asking questions as we do. Mm-hmm. Jews are in the process always of asking questions and answering them with further questions.
Right.
So that's what occurs to me with house,
right,
and the fact that it's, you think of it as stable and staying, but yet it will be destroyed. But a tent, which you do not think is permanent, will flower and grow. So.
Right. That's a really interesting idea. Right? The house is static, flowering is dynamic, and tents are dynamic. When we, you know, when Abraham and Sarah first arrive in the land of Canaan and they travel around, they live in an ohel. And you pick up your ohel, your tent, and you plant it here, and then you pick it up and you plant it somewhere else. So certainly there's a dynamic element to the righteous person, whether I view it in terms of questioning and that type of a dynamism, or simply I look at it in terms of growth. You know, the wicked person is someone who has said, I've had enough, I am who I am, I'm where I am, whereas the righteous person continues to grow, which then, if we wanted to take that to the vineyard piece in the third part, may also have its own have repercussions there. So let's come back to that when we actually go through the deeper meaning of the second part. But I think that I think it's a very good point. The third stage here, we take this sentence from Eov, this really hard sentence from Eov, from Job, 24:18. First of all, when I look at this sentence, the word kal is a loaded word here. You could take kal as swift, which is the way that I translated it, and frankly is the normal translation that is given to it. But what about this sentence? And here you need to be a Hebrew reader in order to catch this. What about this sentence makes you kind of wonder about the word kal? Tikulal, later in the sentence. Later in the sentence, you're going to have the word tikulal, which is also from that root, or would seem to mean cursed. So this could be, if the last underlined line in the Hebrew is where this sentence appears, you could say, well, it's a poet. Yeah. You know, it's simply poetry. So kal tikulal, you have that happen sometimes in Yov. That could be the meaning. But maybe there's something else going on there. Yeah. And then, what's with the vineyards? Why do we pick the vineyards? Obviously, we've already given some note to it, and we can't ignore Noah and his vineyard association. But there's another problem, because I pulled a fast one when I read this third part. Go back to the third part again, please, and tell me something. The people around in the generation of the flood, based on what it says in the third part, you can see it in the Hebrew or in the English, are they planting vineyards or are they not planting vineyards?
They are
planting vineyards, right? Look at the sentence in Eov. He's not planting vineyards. So which is it? We've got a problem. And then the bigger problem is, who is the pronoun? Sharon had that point also? Who is he? It's a great question. Look back at the sentence, right? Yeah, look at my translation there, which is a direct translation. He is swift upon the face of the water. Their portion is cursed in the land. He will not turn to the path of the vineyards. I am completely lost. I don't understand how to read this sentence. Who is the he? Who is the they? Why are we going back and forth? So, what do we do with this? Let's go step by step now, looking at the Medrash with these thoughts about the language that we've now developed. Number one, we're still addressing that same question of why Noah's righteousness is described via his generations. That's the fundamental question that our Medrash wants to solve in the context of Parshat Noah, separate from any comments on verses from Proverbs and Job and whatever else. We draw first on passages that show righteousness causing survival, creating a future, since that's the theme of Noah's life. So that even when a storm arrives, nonetheless, there will be survival. And we associate it with Noah because of the pun of Yisod Olam, foundation of the world, as opposed to eternal foundation. And his own house will survive, even as the general world does not. The second part of this, we draw on a sentence that speaks about more than survival. His righteousness causes toladot, it causes future generations. The righteous will thrive and they will flower. But there, we have this bayit ohel going. So one comment that I saw in the Eitz Yosef commentary, I believe, is to say that it's telling me even if all the righteous person has is a tent, it will be more durable than the house that the wicked person has. Right? Three little pigs, the house made of straw and wooden bricks. So even if he makes it out of bricks, nonetheless, the big bad wolf is going to blow the house down. And the righteous person in the house of straw, maybe bringing in pigs to a shear isn't such a great idea. Fine. The three little chickens. Doesn't have the same ring. Right. So the second part of it is a statement that the tent is going to flower, even if it's only a tent. And here I would go back to Devorah's point about the dynamic tent, because we tend to view that which is static as being more stable and therefore having greater survival possibilities. But in fact, it's the tent that's going to be the one that survives. Yeah?
Could you look at the tent and the house more in another way? Like, even if there might not be much that the righteous do, or it's not so obvious, but what they are doing is going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And they could have built a beautiful house with everything, and that can be destroyed, and no one will even remember that there was that house.
I mean, yeah, I think that's an element. The other piece that I would bring in here, possibly, and this is just pure speculation, which, you know, that's fine. The word ohel has another meaning in Tanakh. Well, there is a tent. There's something else, though, that means beyond tent, especially in Shir HaShirim. Morva ahalot im rashay besamim. Ahalot, ohel, is aloe, a plant. And I wonder, because it's talking about it flowering. Tents don't flower. Aloe may flower, but tents don't flower. So I wonder if there isn't a pun on that, really making him into, because ahalot, or ohel, is particularly something positive in Song of Songs when we describe the relationship between God and the Jews. It's something that is sweet-smelling. It's like a balm, B-A-L-M. So I wonder if there isn't that element to it also. They had some moisturizer, right? So there's that piece to it as well. Okay. Like I said, speculation. That's fine, it's speculation. Yeah.
I am reading it as Hashem will make this Ohel Yeshalim flourish.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that's a simple read. I'm just throwing in this other idea, because tents don't normally flower, that if I wanted to take flower more literally, I could say Ohel is a reference to aloe, which it is elsewhere in Tanakh. That's all.
I don't see Ohel Yeshalim at this point as literally the Ohel.
Okay. That's okay. I'm cool with that. Yeah. Yes.
I just have a comment about, you know, the wicked with the house and the righteous with the tent.
Yeah.
Very often, you know, people get their identity and sense of self from what they have. The righteous get their sense, they have a sense of self, not from what they have, who they are.
So you think the bayit signifies possessions?
And so, like, the wicked, they might have this big house with all of it, but that's not what's important. It's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And who you are is more important. So that you can mm-hmm. live in a tent, and if you are who you are, you don't need the big house.
Right.
But they need the big house because that's where they get their sense. But that's destroyed because.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely hear it. I definitely hear it. Okay. I think there are a lot of layers to the bayit and ohel. There's a lot more that you can do with this in general. But I think these are good. But let's go to the third answer, because otherwise we're going to have to stop without having explained this third answer. In the third answer, we are saying, as we said before, that the righteous person is dedicated to producing dorot, to producing children. The Eitz Yosef commentary says, you know, the word kal doesn't have to mean swift. It can mean klala, which is a curse. And we find associations like that elsewhere in Tanakh for the word kal. So perhaps you could read it as the decree of punishment and therefore go back to the sentence in the Midrash, kal hu al pnei hamayim, the decree cursing them was upon of the water, right? Which is, in fact, the flood. So the who is a reference to the decree. He, or who in the Hebrew, he in English, Abbott and Costello notwithstanding, the statement is, he is swift upon the face of the water, the curse is upon the face of the water. Their portion is cursed in the land, and now you have a nice water and land combination there, once you read it that way. And then the end of the sentence is explaining why. Lo yifneh derech kramim, they did not turn to the vineyards. Now you're going to tell me, but they did turn to the vineyards. Wasn't that what the Midrash was saying? And here we go back to a point that the Eitz Yosef made in a source we saw last week, which is the problem of editions of Midrash. Midrash was not learned with the rigor that Gemara was, and so over time you have multiple manuscripts that develop with actually different editions, where in the Gemara, because you have thousands upon thousands of students who are studying a text carefully, they pick up on things like that and either resolve the different editions or say, well, this edition will lead to this ruling and this edition will lead to that ruling. In Midrash, no one's doing that. And the result is that you can have a manuscript that simply has a mistake. And the Eitz Yosef says, I have found manuscripts that actually read this with one word that's different, a very important word, and that is that instead of saying in the Hebrew in the third answer, kol kach lama lo yifne derech kramim shelo hayta kavanatan ela lemata'at kiramim, rather it's shelo hayta kavanatan lemata'at kiramim. In other words, in the English, instead of saying they intended nothing other than to plant vineyards, it should be read as they did not intend to plant vineyards. It's not about producing children. It's about planting the world. It's about being a farmer. And the statement is that what was wrong with the wicked is like the cricket and that, right, the cricket and the ants. The I forget what the story is called.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Sorry, the ant and the grasshopper. Okay, not a cricket. Sorry. The ants and the grasshopper. Right. They just wanted to play all day long. They weren't interested in planting. And what this does now, and I'm going to come back to this more next week, I hope, but what this does now is turn planting vineyards into a positive instead of a negative. The problem was that they didn't wish to plant. And that's what leads to their curse, whereas Noach's righteousness is in the fact that he is planting. That's the idea. Yes?
So there's another lesson there. You can see two people doing the same thing, but what's very important is their intention behind doing the thing.
What are the thing here?
Whatever they're doing.
Right.
Because they were planting vineyards for...
I'm saying that they weren't.
They weren't planting.
And according to this edition, they didn't plant the vineyards. Right. There's more to see with this. So actually what I'm going to do, rather than rush it, I'm going to call the halt here and just do a very fast summary of what we've seen. We saw three parts to this medrash on the opening sentence in Noah. Our fundamental question is, what is the link between his generations and his righteousness, such that you begin by saying, here are his generations, and then you go off to say he was righteous? Our first answer is, his righteousness was what enabled future generations. It led to survival, like the sentence in Mishlei that says that Tzaddik is the eternal foundation, which we reread as, he's the foundation of the world. Our second answer is that Tzaddik, in his righteousness, will cause future generations to flourish, even if all you have is an ohel, which looks temporary, and it's something that's constantly shifting. Nonetheless, that will have greater permanence than the house of the wicked, which appears to be so stable and have all the possessions and the various explanations that we threw onto that in addition. And then the third point is that he is righteous in terms of his investment in the world. Either that the others were just interested in vineyards and he was producing children, or the others didn't want to plant and Noah chose to plant. We still have to come back to that third part because there's more that we have to see to explain it. I want to also talk about a further lesson here about planting vines and how it relates to Noah. And before we do a summary of it as well, next week, to talk about some of the goals of this medrash. One note, I mentioned last time that my desire in doing medrash as our topic for this year has been because I want for myself to be able to really do medrash in a serious way. I want to make sure, though, to calibrate this so that it's good for the people who are here, so that everybody's going to get something out of it. I recognize that the more time we spend on nuances in text, the harder it may be for some who don't have a text background. So do me a favor, please. I would appreciate feedback from people during the course of the week on how the text focus works for you, whether it's good, whether it's a little much, whether you're looking for more of it, because that'll help me to calibrate it properly for those who are here. Once again, as I said last week, I have to run out promptly in order to get my next commitment.
Okay, so, and now-